violently. Several small explosions could be felt running through the floor under his shoes.
"The boilers must be breaking loose," Andrew said. "Soon the ship will break apart."
Kare continued her silent stare, doing nothing.
"Then we are to die together, is that it?"
The explosions continued. Below deck, walls began to collapse as the boilers crashed through to the bow. The deck tilted extensively.
"She's dying!" Andrews cried. "My ship is dying!"
Andrews went into an uncontrollable rage. Death was near. As if on cue, Kare attacked. The mummy grabbed Andrews by the throat. She continued with her laughing. Clouds of dust flew up from her ancient lungs, hitting Andrews in the face. The shipbuilder did not give up. Andrews spotted a small knife lying next to a fallen chair.
"Don't give up, Thomas," the Irishman thought. "The time has not yet come for you to die."
Andrews broke loose from the monster's grip, and the shipbuilder ran for the little knife, pointing it back at his attacker. They stood silent, watching the other.
"I have you now," Andrews said with pride.
A thundering crash came through the smoking room, causing an outer wall to collapse. Before either Kare or Andrews could react, a wall of water hit them. Andrews dropped his knife. Bridge, 2:30 a.m. By some great miracle unknown to Captain Smith, the bridge was still above water. Perhaps he thought it was mainly because of the Titanic's terrible list to port. He knew that the end was near. The boats were gone. Only a few collapsible lifeboats remained. Smith could see the water rising above the loading cranes, bubbling in white foam over the cargo hatches as air escaped the ship's bow. He saw his own extinction.
"This is how it ends for me," the captain said out loud. "The world's most expensive seaman. To die at the helm of a ship that couldn't even reach its first port of call."
It was too fantastic a fate for Smith to comprehend. It was a footnote to history he wouldn't even award to his worst childhood enemy. One last duty had to be done. It was time to release what men were left on board. The captain headed toward the port wing bridge, failing to notice the water pouring into the bridge at his right.
"Men!" the captain shouted through his megaphone. "God bless you! Abandon ship! It's every man for himself. Help those that you can, but above all, be British! Be British!"
Smith could see his officers below him waving firearms in the air, trying their best to protect the collapsible lifeboats as crying babies were being soothed by terrified mothers. He saw desperate men tearing clothes from their bodies, tying deck chairs together, hoping to build a raft. Maybe it would work? He dearly hoped so. Dropping his megaphone, Smith turned back toward the bridge to notice his ship's foremast. Alone, in a sea of dark water, with only an occasional deck chair or crate bouncing into it, the mast was sinking deeper and deeper. Soon, the red light at the top would dive beneath the abyss.
"If only I had gotten those damn binoculars Fleet had asked for," Smith said with the deepest regret.
A rumble caught the captain's attention. Hit with a wall of water, Smith was thrown from the ship. The Titanic lost her captain. A deck, first class promenade. First Officer Murdoch couldn't stand to hear the cries of anguish anymore.
"Please save my child," a woman pleaded.
"Dear God, why me?" a sailor asked.
"Someone stole my life belt,"
a wealthy old gentleman complained.
"Christ,"
a steerage woman prayed. Screams were all around. A shudder was felt through the entire length of the ship. As the bow continued to sink below the water, the ship's aft continued her trek skyward. It was becoming almost impossible to stand. Grown men, like in the days of their beginnings, began to crawl toward the stern on their knees. Murdoch fell to the deck, holding onto a pipe or vent of some kind. He was too confused to know which. The first officer pulled out a handgun he had been keeping in his pocket.
"God will forgive me," he prayed. "I just know that he will."
Tears started to run down the first officer's cheeks. Water had covered the ship up to the first funnel and was working itself toward the second. She was starting to drop in the water like a stone. Murdoch looked at the water approaching him. He looked at those floating below, the unlucky ones. the dead ones. Murdoch pulled back the hammer of his weapon.
Claw marks, he cried. Sweet Mary, there are claw marks on the decks.
The first officer placed a shaky finger on the trigger. The officer noticed that he was being watched.
Shoot us first, Gov, a passenger pleaded.
Murdoch noticed three men holding on desperately to a railing not 6 feet from his feet. From where they were hanging, there was no hope of ever gaining enough footing to reach the stern. They were as stuck as he was.
I was not born to be a murderer, Murdoch finally brought himself to say. Dear God, for the love of your mother, man,
one of these men pleaded.
Would you be feeding us to the sharks, then?
Sharks,
the first officer said, panic clearly in his voice.
God in heaven, never once did I think about sharks. They'll be feeding on us for days.
Murdoch pointed his gun out toward the men. His hand shook wildly, the barrel pointing every which way.
Swear to me, lads, now at the hour of your deaths, that in God's name and on your words as gentlemen that you forgive me.
Between a bullet and a shark, laughed one man with a bitter irony. I'll take a shot, even if it be coming from the hand of an Englishman.
In the squeeze of a trigger, two men lay dead, one close to it. An Irishman looked at his wound and gave Murdoch a smile.
Let there be peace between you and me, British. May your mother sing of your deeds until her dying day.
His eyes rolled white. He was dead. The first officer never killed a man in cold blood. It was a horrible feeling. He was glad that he was about to die. He kept his eyes on the three men below him as their bodies disappeared underneath the rising foam. The water was after him now.
Damn!
The first officer screamed in a fury, not knowing what else to do. Murdoch placed the still smoking gun in his mouth. So hot was the barrel that it burnt his tongue. A second later, all his troubles were over. B deck, second class promenade, 2:32 a.m. Kotz fell to the deck to be struck on the head by the ship's piano. The band stopped playing and only Wallace Hartley remained by his side.
Mr. Kotz, are you all right?
Concerned and soaked from head to toe, Hartley helped Kotz to his feet. The men discovered that the deck was becoming an impossible platform to stand on.
I guess that I'm alive, Kotz said rather absent-mindedly.
The detective found that he was bleeding.
We have to reach the stern, sir, Hartley managed to say. Follow me. I'll show you a way to beat the crowds.
Kotz realized that the band was no longer by their leader's side.
What of the band? Your men?
I dismissed them, sir. They have done their duty.
The band leader motioned Kotz to follow him to a service ladder located by the second-class smoking room. The ladder led to the roof above A deck.
My flute!
Kotz panicked, feeling his pockets wildly. The detective was openly livid. He searched his pockets and discovered that his prized musical instrument was nowhere to be found.
I've lost my flute. I must find my flute.
Kotz started to flip over fallen deck chairs, of which there were many, seeing if his flute was anywhere in sight. The detective stopped his actions suddenly when Hartley shoved Kotz's familiar oblong brown bag in front of his face.
What on earth?
Kotz said with surprise, taking the flute from the band leader.
Such a promising student shouldn't lose his instrument.
Kotz thanked the man and both headed for the utility ladder.
What are we going to do once we reach the stern? The detective asked.
Jump. What else?
Kotz noticed the wall of water fast approaching them. He climbed the ship's roof, watching with wonder as the force of the onrushing water caused the supports of the second smokestack to give way and then finally tumble the massive tower as if it were made of paper.
Hurry, Hartley replied. We haven't much time. I have friends on board.
Don't we all?
The men scaled the Titanic's upper deck as if it were a mountain. Kotz looked over his shoulder to witness the final plunge of the second funnel. Hartley stopped his track up toward the stern. Kotz could see that something caught the band leader's attention.
What's wrong?
Kotz asked. Hartley pointed to the deck below them.
Dear God!
The detective gawked. The men watched as a tiny crack started to run across the ship, getting larger with every passing second.
She's going to break,
Hartley yelled.
We have to hurry.
The men ran for their lives.
The Titanic started to twist. Given the sheer weight of all the water in the forward section of the ship, and taking into account that the Titanic's stern was never designed to be taken out of the water and thrown around like a stick, the iron plates surrounding the midsection of the ship took on a taffy-like consistency. The tug of war between the flooded sections of the ship compared with those of the dry was becoming too much for the liner to handle. The screams at the stern turned silent as a series of rumbles were heard crashing throughout the entire length of the vessel.
"There go the boilers!" a sailor yelled.
Cotts and Hartley made their way toward the steps leading down the stern decks. With a final crash, the ship's lights went out. In that instant, it seemed as if the entire world paused. The screams stopped. All who were left on board realized that they were doomed. Shining in her intensity, the Titanic had given those who were the most skeptical a feeling of hope. The ship was dark. Help would never see them.
"Do you hear that?"
Hartley asked Cotts, grabbing the detective by the arm. Cotts stopped. A tearing sound, like no other ever imaginable, thundered into the quiet night. Cotts saw the third funnel suddenly disappear below the water.
"Run!" Hartley yelled.
Cotts, screaming, ran toward the stern section of the ship. He could feel the deck buckling under his feet.
"We're not going to make it!" the lawman cried.
The deck disappeared from underneath Cotts' feet. The detective sprang into the air, reaching for the deck in front of him, which appeared to still be intact. Cotts landed. With the wind knocked out of him, he noticed that the stern was starting to level out. Was the Titanic finally righting herself?
"Mr. Cotts!"
Hartley screamed. The voice came from behind. Cotts saw what happened. The first 500 feet of the ship was gone. Like a cork bobbing up and down in a tub of water, the stern of the Titanic was all that was left of the beautiful vessel.
"Mr. Cotts!" the voice yelled again. "Help me, please!"
Where the ship broke apart, Cotts noticed a pair of hands grasping hold of the deck. Cotts discovered Hartley hanging on for dear life. The band leader was not as lucky as the ex-Scotland Yard man. He was not fast enough. Hartley appeared to be dazed, not wishing to accept the incredible chain of events he was experiencing. The man's face strained white with fear.
"Come now, lad," Cotts said. "Grab my hand."
Wallace Hartley was relieved. He relaxed. Cotts peered over the side of the deck as he helped his friend up. Like a stack of cards, exposed decks of the ship showed themselves to the harsh night. One by one, each started to once more fill with water. So overwhelmed by what he saw, Cotts paused in his help for Hartley.
"Are you going to help me up?" Hartley asked.
Purple in the face, Cotts could see that the chill in the air was starting its rough work on the musician.
"Sorry, lad. Here we go."
Cotts slipped on the ice forming all around him. The decks were starting to tilt drastically.
"It's difficult, son," Cotts tried to explain. "Take your time. I have all night."
The Titanic's stern sank fast. From out of the darkness, a deck below Cotts, a huge table came rolling out of its room, hitting Hartley square in the chest. The band leader, unaware of the danger, started to lose his grip.
"Mr. Cotts!"
Hartley screamed in terror. The musician lost one hand to surprise and found himself dangling from the other. The table falling shattered as it hit a reciprocating engine below.
"Give me your other hand, boy!"
the detective shouted, referring to the hand Hartley was waving in the air as he continued to stare at the massive engine below him.
"Don't look down!"
Hartley scraped the splintered wood of the deck above him and reacted to the pain. Instinctively letting go of his only chance at life, the band leader was gone. Cotts grabbed emptily for the musician's hands, hoping to catch them before they were out of reach. All the detective could do was watch. Like the bed before him, Wallace Hartley, band leader of the Titanic, landed on the engine below. He died instantly. Cotts had no time for remorse. The water was fast reaching him. B deck, poop deck. Parker grabbed the aft flagpole and fought with a huge banner symbolizing the British Merchant Service. The huge flag kept getting in his way. He knew that he had to jump. Parker climbed the white railing and discovered that his knees were shaking. What the hell am I doing? He asked himself. I can't swim.
Parker pushed away from the ship with all of his might and splashed down into the icy waters below.
In the water, he could see the bodies.
Bodies of men who were not as successful as he. They all jumped off the stern, managing to mangle themselves hitting the rudder and propellers below. Frantically, Parker started to fling his arms in the water, doing all that was within his power to stay afloat.
Parker wasn't succeeding. He sank like a rock.
Sailors floating in the water grabbed hold of Parker's hands. Several men who managed to create a raft from the debris floating near the ship saved Parker from his fear of drowning.
"Come now, sir," said a sailor. "Grab hold of this box and she'll take care of you."
Regaining his strength, Parker held on to the empty wooden box and managed to look up at what was left of the Titanic. Like a finger pointing its way to heaven, the Titanic began to turn in the water. Screams could be heard coming from the terrified hundreds hanging on and knowing that they were about to die. Then, as if by magic, the ship froze.
"Look!" a sailor yelled. "She's holding!"
It seemed an eternity to Parker, but it did look as if the stern section was holding her ground. Several people dived off the ship in turn, coaching still others to follow. The magic did not last for long. One last explosion was heard as the great liner started to sink. As the waters closed over the Titanic's proud name, Parker caught a glimpse of the British Merchant Service flag as it disappeared below the icy waters. The Titanic was no more.
"It's over," Parker found himself saying.
The sailor, patting Parker on the back, started to yell out frantic orders, telling all within his reach to start paddling away from where the ship had been.
"Swim! Swim!" the sailor shouted. "A suction is bound to get us if we don't."
Parker could feel a pulling force under the water. With no questions asked, he moved his feet as fast as he possibly could. After going through so much, he was not about to be killed by a ship's whirlpool. One by one, there was a yelp as the Titanic claimed another victim. Parker escaped reality, collapsing into darkness. Chapter 17. North Atlantic Ocean. 41 minutes, 46 seconds north, 50 minutes, 14 seconds west, estimated. 3 o'clock a.m. Parker was awakened from his sleep by a splash of icy water. His fingers were losing their grip, and he found that his life jacket was becoming increasingly heavy. It was causing him to sink.
"Help!" he yelled. "I can't swim! Help!"
No one heard him.
"Dear God, don't let me die here. Not here," a voice cried in the night.
The voice was not alone in its chorus. The night air was filled with screams. Grown men like Parker were pleading to a God who seemed not to be listening. In the distance beyond the screams, Parker heard the distinctive sound of someone blowing a whistle.
"Whistle," Parker mumbled. "Who'd be blowing a whistle?"
Parker tightened his grip on the sides of the box he had been floating on and peered over its edge to see a group of men gathered on an overturned lifeboat. A Titanic officer was at the head of this boat, and it was he who was blowing the whistle.
"Lightoller."
Parker started to kick his feet, hoping to paddle himself toward the lifeboat. His vision was impaired by the cold. He listened eagerly for the rhythmic whistleblowing, which was leading him to safety. A shudder of pain hit Parker. His body was reacting to the cold of the icy waters and was dangerously close to hypothermia.
"Ah!"
he screamed. His hands gave up the box he was holding, and before Parker knew what was happening, he was once more below the waters, sinking into the darkness of the Atlantic Ocean. Parker didn't have the strength to raise to the top. He started to believe that he was going to die. Parker could feel something grabbing his leg. It was something from below. He looked toward whatever it was that grabbed his leg, blinking his tired eyes. A flash of gold came from out of the darkness, and with a push, Parker was above the water, coughing, vomiting, and gasping for air.
"Are you all right, son?" an old voice shouted into Parker's ear.
Parker's eyes widened with surprise.
"Captain Smith, I thought that you were dead," Smith said, grabbing a couple floating deck chairs. This is the 20th century, young man. The captain doesn't have to go down with his ship. It was a tempting impulse. How did you make it?
I really can't say. All I remember was being washed over the bridge wing by the biggest wave I have ever seen.
Smith chuckled.
I do remember holding on to a port cargo door. Then the ship broke up.
Smith stopped, closing his eyes.
Dear God, what a way to end a career.
All Parker could do was look at Smith, silently fighting the cold. Collapsible B Lifeboat, 3:15 a.m. Kotz stood on the keel of the overturned lifeboat, listening to every order Second Officer Lightoller was giving. Lightoller, suffering from frostbite to the face, was blowing his whistle. Not only was the man trying to bring all the lifeboats together, he was also instructing the people on his boat not to place too much weight on her. Overturned, the lifeboat was constantly under the threat of sinking.
"Right, men," Lightoller ordered, holding his whistle between his teeth. "Lean to the left. To the left. Stand fast."
Kotz was standing behind a man who claimed to be one of the bakers stationed on the Titanic. From time to time, the ex-Scotland Yard inspector could swear that he smelled alcohol in the baker's breath.
"Mr. Lightoller."
The second officer turned his head toward Kotz.
"What?"
Lightoller barked, shivering terribly.
"Do you hear that?"
Lightoller paused, putting an ear to the air.
"Hear what?"
"That talking."
"Who in the hell would be conversing at a time like this?"
the officer pointed out, unknowingly being rude. Kotz looked down toward the sides of the lifeboat where several other men were hanging onto the ropes. A remark came from a stoker, one of only a few who was lucky enough to escape from the engine room.
"Whoever it is talking, Gov, has gone ruddy insane."
The talking caught the second officer's attention. In his surprise, he ironically chuckled,
"Mr. Kotz is right. Someone is talking."
Lightoller headed toward the strange sound, if only to discover who the maniac was.
"Keep it steady, lads," Lightoller ordered.
3:20 a.m.
"Glad that you could join our little party," Kotz shouted, happy to see his American friend.
The overturned lifeboat reached Parker and Captain Smith within 5 minutes of Kotz hearing the captain's talking. Lightoller was pleased to see his captain alive. He was also relieved to find another who could take over command of his lifeboat. The second officer was exhausted.
"Help the captain on board," Lightoller ordered. "Someone's going to have to jump off."
The lifeboat was barely floating. To keep its keel even, Lightoller ordered some of its passengers to jump off, lightening the load. If the captain was to come on board, someone had to give up his spot. Kotz jumped into the water.
"Thank you, Mr. Kotz,"
Smith managed to say. He was starting to turn blue from the cold.
"Your sacrifice is appreciated."
Kotz, swimming over to help Parker, gave his friend a weak smile.
"I couldn't save Thomas," Parker cried.
Kotz read the regret in his young friend's face.
"I'm sure you did your best, lad," the detective consoled.
Kotz noticed a tint of blue forming around Parker's lips. The water was getting to him.
"Grab hold of the boat while you still have the strength to do it with."
Meekly, Parker complied.
"How's the ship, Mr. Lightoller?" Smith asked.
"Rocky, sir."
Lightoller's hand stayed in the air, guiding the men on board, hoping not to tip the small craft over.
"Too much weight and we will go under."
"Understood."
Smith grabbed hold of the capsized boat and started to raise himself out of the water. Lightoller saw something grab hold of the captain, throwing him away from the ship.
"What the devil?"
Lightoller exclaimed. His eyes scanned the water. The second officer saw something coming out of the water like an attacking shark. Ka Ray spotted her victim and swam toward him. Smith, unaware of the danger, innocently swam back toward Lightoller's boat.
"Your captain seems to be losing his grip,"
Smith joked. All the men laughed. All except Lightoller.
"Captain," he said with some urgency, "head back as fast as you can."
Ka Ray sprouted out of the water and once again separated Captain Smith from the lifeboat. The men, seeing Ka Ray for the first time, mistook her for a surviving female passenger.
When she turned to challenge Lytoler's warnings, the moonlight showed all the truth. Ka-Ra had been damaged by the separation of the Titanic. Most of her facial bandages were gone, revealing dried brown skin beneath. A hollow socket spilled water where once there had been an eye. No more would she be the beauty of the ancient world. Parker and Ka-Ra exchanged looks. Ka-Ra pushed Smith still farther away from his only chance at salvation, swimming toward Parker, who, like the rest of the men, did his best to avoid her.
"Get away," Parker pleaded. "Haven't you done enough?"
Ka-Ra's face floated inches from that of Parker's. He could see a smile forming on what was left of her lips. Ka-Ra embraced him. They kissed. It was a frightening, longing, passionate, and macabre embrace. The kiss had a love in its own right, a love Parker surrendered to.
"Sweet mother of God,"
Lytoler said with horror. Ka-Ra let Parker go and was amazed to see tears in the eyes of the man she had embraced.
"It's true, then,"
Ka-Ra thought.
"He honors me."
Softly patting Parker on the cheek, Ka-Ra turned her attention to Captain Smith. She embraced him and disappeared below the depths. Smith's screams were covered by the dark Atlantic waters.
"Why?"
Kotz asked.
"Why, Smith?"
"She needed one more sacrifice," Parker explained. "Who better than the captain?"
Parker softly touched his lips. They were warm. He was no longer cold. It was as if Ka-Ra had given him a new lease on life. A final testament? He couldn't say. Lytoler, doing his best to regain command composure, returned to his whistleblowing.
"The first bugger who mentions any of this to anyone, I'll personally see to it that they spend the rest of their life in a madhouse,"
the second officer warned. On board the lifeboat, the cold claimed another victim. Kotz informed Lytoler of the death, and the dead man was lowered softly into the icy water. Parker was allowed to take his place on the keel.
"Keep up your cheer, lads," Lytoler said. "The Carpathia is on her way. There'll be hot tea for everyone."
The screams that had been ringing throughout the night eventually fell silent. Bodies were so thick on top of the water that neither passenger nor sailor could tell whether their hull was hitting ice or human flesh. The Carpathia did arrive, much to her own captain's horror. Chapter 18. RMS Carpathia, 200 miles from New York, 3 o'clock p.m. Parker woke to find himself in a warm bed. Confused, he wondered if the sinking of the Titanic had been a nightmare.
"Are you all right?" a woman's voice rang out.
Slowly, Parker turned his attention to a ship's nurse who was wringing out a wet cloth, placing it on his head.
"Where am I?"
he asked. The nurse smiled, patting Parker's head with the wet cloth. A medicated smell from the fabric was starting to make him giddy.
"Nurse," he insisted, "are you going to answer me?"
"Shh," the nurse ordered.
"Heaven forbid. Haven't you been through enough these last few hours to go about giving orders to those who have just saved you from an icy death?"
Parker gave the nurse a blank stare.
"The Titanic?"
"Yes. They'll be picking up the bodies, I dare say, for the next 6 months. White Star and the British Board of Trade here have a lot to answer for."
"Where am I?"
"On board the Carpathia, bound for New York." The nurse placed the wet cloth back into a ceramic bowl. Parker noticed the insignia of the Cunard Lines, ironically White Star's primary competitor.
"Rest for now," the nurse ordered. "You have lost much from the cold. A friend of yours was here to see you a couple hours ago. She was quite concerned."
Parker's eyes blinked open.
"She?"
"Yes, a young lady. Do you not know the girl, then?"
Confused, Parker blankly stared. He had nobody.
"For a stranger, she cried several tears," the nurse innocently smiled. "Perhaps it was one of those ship romances one reads about."
Parker slowly drifted into a deep sleep. April 16th, 1912. 150 miles from New York. 10:30 a.m.
"Excuse me, sir,"
a ship's steward said, noticing the sad American's blank stare. Parker turned from the ship's rail, giving the young man a calm look.
"Yes? May I help you?"
"Perhaps you can help me find the first-class dining room," Parker said after a long pause. The steward pointed down the deck.
"Past the barber shop, 2 doors to the right."
"Thanks." Parker started to walk away.
"Sir."
He turned back.
"Yes?"
"You were on the Titanic." Parker nodded.
"What was it like, sir?"
"Ever been in a war, son?"
"No, sir," the steward said. "Never had the pleasure." "Ever smelled death?"
The steward made a face.
"That was the Titanic."
The steward watched in silence as Parker entered the dining room. First-class dining room / smoking room.
"It was a total disaster of mismanagement," Ismay declared.
The director of the White Star Line stood proudly among what was left of the Titanic's wealthy and powerful, doing his best to explain the disaster and at the same time his pride. All on board knew of his cowardice.
"I simply do not follow your logic in this manner, Mr. Ismay,"
Kotz fought, disgust visible on the man's face.
"Who are you, sir, to be questioning me?" Ismay demanded.
"Someone who wasn't allowed to silently walk onto a lifeboat," Kotz retorted.
Ismay took off his hat. A fight was in the making.
"You've insulted me, sir," Ismay declared.
He raised his voice so that all in the room could hear. Kotz, rolling up his sleeves, noticed Parker as he walked into the room. The detective ignored the silent betting that was going on between Carpathia passengers and Titanic survivors and walked away from Ismay.
"Dennis," Kotz rejoiced. "Good to see you up and about. How are you doing?"
Parker took notice of Ismay's angry look and Kotz rolled up sleeves. He knew that he walked into the middle of some trouble.
"I guess that I'm all right. What's going on here?"
"Nothing I can't handle. Mr. Ismay's challenging the facts. He blames the sinking on Smith's incompetence as an officer."
"Incompetence," Parker yelled. "The man ordered the captain to continue with the voyage, even after you asked him to reconsider."
Kotz tried to calm Parker down. Ismay, barely hearing the angry yell, barked back challenges to the detective.
"Have no fear, lad," Kotz cautioned. "The British Crown will look into this matter, as will, I dare say, your government. The truth will come out."
Ismay walked over toward the two men.
"What's the matter, Kotz? Scotland Yard turn you into a woman?"
The man doubled his fists, waving them in the air.
"I want justice."
"Then talk to God," Kotz barked.
Several men standing next to the ship's bar started to laugh.
"Andrews warned you," Parker added.
Ismay studied Parker.
"I know you, don't I?"
"Professor Parker, I was Thomas Andrews' friend."
Ismay gave Parker a hollow glance.
"You lied to him," Parker challenged. "You told him that there was nothing wrong with the construction codes on the Titanic."
"What was wrong with the Titanic?" Ismay smirked. "She was designed by an Irishman."
Parker's tired face turned hard.
"Calm down, Dennis," Kotz warned. "Remember that you're a Catholic. Turn the other cheek, lad."
Parker wasn't listening. He followed Bruce Ismay to the bar. Ismay, too involved in his own world, paid little attention to the man behind him. A big mistake.
"Thomas was a great shipbuilder. He was an artist."
"Tell that to the women and children he killed."
Ismay bought a glass of whiskey, tipped the bartender, and drank the drink down in one gulp. Parker noticed that Ismay was drunk. Was the guilt already working on him? Or was Ismay afraid of the truth?
"You self-centered bastard," Parker said.
"Are you threatening me, Yank?"
"I hate being called a Yank,"
Parker said, doubling up his fists. Before Kotz could stop the man, Parker hit Ismay square in the mouth. Cheers rang throughout the room.
"Good hit, lad," Kotz said, holding back a smile.
Ismay wiped the blood off his face. He rose to his feet. No one helped him.
Kotz, you saw it.
Ismay pointed a shaking finger right at Parker.
This man attacked me. Upon reaching New York, sir, I intend to bring you up on charges.
On what grounds? Parker asked.
Kotz, you saw.
Saw what? Kotz smiled. Ismay's mouth opened with surprise.
This man assaulted me.
No, sir.
What? Are you blind?
Ismay could not believe what he was hearing.
I saw nothing of the kind. As far as I'm concerned, you slipped on a bar of soap.
Kotz and Parker left the room. Both cheered. Carpathia, poop deck, 1:45 p.m. Kotz and Parker looked out at the rolling waves of the icy Atlantic as they brutally smashed up against the hull of their rescue ship, Carpathia. On the far-off horizon, the men could barely make out the gray haze of North America.
Jesus, Parker said, breaking the peaceful quiet. Is that what Thomas will be remembered for?
Kotz said nothing. He continued to stare at the choppy water below. His eyes were fixed on a floating deck chair, probably from the Titanic.
They'll be picking up debris from her for the next 6 months, the detective mused. All that beauty, all that power, all that is left of her is bad memories.
Kotz patted Parker on the back.
Your friend, Mr. Andrews, was an honest man.
Honesty seems to be dying in this world, Mr. Kotz.
It survives, son. It survives.
The man was the best in his class. Built ships to last.
I'm sure that he did.
Parker paused.
All he'll ever be remembered for is the Titanic.
The truth will be heard in time, Kotz reassured.
Parker, tired, meekly shook his head.
Excuse me, sirs, a female voice came from behind. Mary Sloane, the brave stewardess that the men met in the third-class smoking room during the blackout, stood inches from them. In her hands, she was carrying a standard oblong wooden case. Andrew's case.
Mrs. Sloane.
Kotz tipped his hat, recognizing the case. He was surprised to see it. More than once, he noticed Andrews with it in his hands.
Can we help you in some way?
Mary Sloane slowly handed Andrew's case to Parker. Like an excited child at Christmas time, Parker was more than happy to take the item. He held it, studying it as if he were studying a rare antique.
He wanted you to have this, Mary Sloane smiled.
How on earth did you ever?
Parker asked, knowing full well that Andrews never let anyone touch his blueprints. I ran into him before the ship went down.
Indeed.
Kotz's curiosity was starting to get the better of him. He reached into his vest pocket and was disappointed to discover that he lost his notepad and pencil. He gave Mary and Parker a frown.
Yes, Mary continued.
He was acting rather queer, Mr. Parker.
Quite strange indeed.
Parker directed Mary Sloane to a bench located outside the Carpathia's reading room. All three, still tired from their ordeal, took a seat.
Please, tell me what happened.
Parker placed Andrew's wooden case on his lap, holding it like a beloved pet.
I was running down the first-class staircase, hoping to help those that I could before the final plunge. Reaching the smoking room, I heard a noise. Looking in, I thought to find a drunk or maybe even a lost child in need of her mother. Instead, I found Mr. Andrews. I still remember him, silently staring at that oil painting.
I found him like that, Parker said, remembering. I tried to get him out on deck, but the stubborn bastard wouldn't listen.
I begged him to follow me out onto the boat deck,
Mary explained, a hint of hurt in her voice. There were questions to be answered, questions that only he could ask.
He still wouldn't listen, Kotz asked.
No. Instead, he told me to give you that case, Mr. Parker. He said that it would contain all you would need to carry on.
All three looked at the case in silence. Finally, Mary got up, excused herself, and headed into the ship's hospital. She had been volunteering as a nurse. Parker picked up the case and played with it a little, almost afraid to open it.
Open it, Kotz softly ordered.
Parker opened it. Inside were the complete blueprints of the Titanic, Andrew's notes, and a statement to the British Parliament about the cost cuts made on his ship without his knowledge. Everything needed to defend Andrew's name.
"Dear God," Parker said as he looked over it all. "It's all here. Every last nut and bolt."
"What's this?" Kotz inquired, reaching for a small envelope. The detective reached for a letter that dropped on the deck. In all the excitement, the men failed to see the tiny piece of paper. It was a personal letter addressed to the two of them from Andrews. "The White Star Lines, RMS Titanic. This message is sent to Dennis Parker and Inspector Reginald Kotz, formerly of Scotland Yard. Dear friends, I sit here in the smoking room waiting for my fate to catch up with me. However, I hope that the two of you are well and alive. Dennis, please give these papers to my wife, for she will know where to put them. Although guilty, if the truth were known about the Titanic, it would ruin my uncle's company. That is something I could never allow. Do not hate me for choosing the death that I have, but respect my final wishes, in the hopes that my family will be spared the humiliation. Going down with the ship will make my family heroes. Alive, I would make them relatives of a murderer. Mr. Kotz, it is my understanding that when, upon reaching Canada, you plan to write your memoirs. When writing, please forget this adventure. Dennis, I believe that you blame yourself for this disaster. If I am right in this belief, please do not torture yourself in this matter. Although your cargo caused a few murders, I fail to see how it could have had anything to do with the berg that struck the ship. This was a fate meant to happen. Do you remember me telling you of the fantastic leaps in science, which I feel will come true before the end of this century? Maybe this disaster is God's way of reminding us of our limitations. Perhaps science needs a few disasters before we can go forward. If so, then the Titanic's death might not be one in vain. This letter, Dennis, is for you to keep. Do not allow Helen or my daughter to ever see it. I beg you. I sit here, watching my ship as she slowly tilts out of control. I hope that I can find a responsible person who is willing to give this letter and its contents to you. I know of your fear of the water, and if you are alive, I know that you have survived one of your worst nightmares. There still remains another. Find someone. Find someone to share your life with. Have children. Leave your imprint on the face of mankind. God forgive me for my ignorance. If I had known how unstable the Titanic was, I would have never let her leave the docks of Ireland. However, upon my immortal soul, I state here in this letter that the Olympic is as sound as the Empire. I do recommend that her watertight bulkheads be lowered, leveled, and that her hull is reinforced with a secondary wall adding to her flotation. It's now all in your hands, Dennis. The Lord watch over you. Thomas Andrews. Parker's tear-filled eyes gazed up from the White Star letterhead, giving Kotz a helpless stare. The detective, although he was never close to Andrews, was moved. Parker couldn't hold back any longer. He burst out into tears and fell to his knees. All Kotz could do was watch. 10 o'clock p.m.
"I understand, son," Kotz later said, biting into a Danish roll he obtained from the Carpathia's kitchen.
He and Parker had been late sleepers for the last 2 days and had each time missed dinner.
"I feel like a damn fool. I should have held my own," Parker raged. "My father said a man should only cry when he is alone."
"You were," Kotz reassured.
Parker patted Kotz on the back, knowing that a sacred pact existed between them. After all, if both could survive the Titanic, could they not survive themselves? Kotz, finishing his Danish, noticed a curious stare in his friend's face. Parker was scanning the decks of the ship as if looking for a familiar face.
"Excuse me, son. You appear rather absent-minded. Besides the disaster we have shared, is something bothering you?"
"No, not really."
"Remember, I'm here to help," Kotz reassured, patting Parker on the back.
Parker stopped his walking. They liked to walk the decks, wanting to see the shores of the New World before reaching New York Harbor.
"Did you come to visit me when I was in the ship's hospital?" Parker asked.
Kot's face turned curious.
Yes, you were sleeping. I was out for hours myself. You didn't see anyone else.
Kotz studied Parker's face.
What's bothering you? The nurse told me that a woman had come to see me. She said that this woman showed great concern for my welfare. Did you know any women on board the Titanic? Not really.
Parker's eyes started to widen with surprise. He looked up the deck toward the ship's bridge. The American's body began to shake with uncertainty. Kotz noticed a woman walking out of a nearby passageway taking off a pair of white gloves. The woman wasn't that much older than Parker, and after a few minutes he recognized her as one of the chambermaids on board the Titanic. Then he looked at Parker.
Dennis, do you know her?
Catherine Lee turned to walk down the deck when she suddenly stopped, noticing Parker.
Kathy?
Parker finally brought himself to say. Instantly, upon hearing her name, the young woman ran toward Parker, grabbing him around the waist, embracing him with a kiss. Kotz smiled, rather surprised.
I think that we have found your mysterious visitor.
April 18th, 1912. New York Harbor, Pier Number 54, 9 o'clock p.m. New York City planned a great reception for the Titanic. No one could have seen the disaster ahead. The whole world was stunned. All in the harbor was quiet as the Carpathia was slowly pulled up the city's great water lanes. New York's flags were at half-mast. Parker and Catherine were bound by the disaster. Kotz noticed the love that had been growing in their eyes and saw it as a beautiful thing. If anything good was to come from this tragedy, it had to be this.
Have you decided what you're going to do once we reach dock?
Kotz asked. Parker, breaking away from a kiss, gave his friend a puzzled look.
Stay away from the water.
Kotz laughed.
No, no, no. I mean regarding Carl Ray. What are you going to tell the press?
Nothing. Parker paused. However, I think I might consider writing a book on the power of curses.
That is, of course, after our wedding, Kathy stated.
Kotz gawked with glee.
You're joshing.
Nope, Parker said with pride. It's about time that I settled down. In a sense, Thomas was right. I've found what I have been looking for.
Well, Kotz said, I wish only the best for the both of you.
What of you, my friend? Parker said. What will you be doing?
I'm moving to Canada, Kotz said with pride.
America not to your liking, then?
Nothing of the kind, Kotz protested. In fact, I plan to visit much of the American West before I die.
If you're ever in New York, look me up.
Parker shook Kotz's hand, embracing the man as a father.
It'll be a pleasure, Kotz said, touched.
Kotz reached into his coat pocket and pulled out his flute.
In the meantime, allow me to play a tune for the bride.
Gladly,
Catherine said. Kotz cleared his throat, blowing into his flute. He played an old Irish dance he learned long ago. It was, poetically, a wedding song, and Parker and Catherine knew it well. Several passerbys noticed the jovial music and joined in the couple's dancing. The tugs slowly maneuvered the Carpathia into her assigned dock. The worst was over. Parker looked over his shoulder, feeling a chill. The ocean was strangely calm. An inner voice told him that Ka Ray was out there somewhere waiting.
What's wrong? Catherine asked.
Nothing.
Catherine could see that something was bothering Parker, but she paid it no heed. She was happy. She wanted only to dance.
Is there a child in the world who does not believe in magic? Parker asked himself, studying the ocean's horizon.
Parker knew that somewhere, out in the dark Atlantic, there loomed an evil capable of almost anything. He prayed a silent prayer, hoping that no one would ever again disturb its ancient sleep. This has been Dark Passenger, written by Donald Allen Kirch, narrated by Holly Jackson. Copyright 2017 by Donald Allen Kirch. Production copyright 2018 by Donald Allen Kirch.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.